Welcome to Between the Before and After, a podcast about the stories that shape us. I'm your host, Coach John McLernan, and each episode I bring you an inspiring guest with a moving story that shines a light on the power of the human spirit. Before we dive in, I want to let you know about two very important things. Number one, the stories shared here are often gritty, raw, and vulnerable, and very likely will include speaking about sensitive topics suited for a mature audience. Number two, this podcast is also broadcast live on YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. So on whatever platform you follow myself or Freedom Nutrition Coaching, you have the opportunity to participate in this discussion. You can comment on the live stream, and we encourage your participation both by commenting and asking questions. So this podcast is about exploring the stories that take place between the before and after photos, not just in the realm of weight loss, but in all areas of life. So let's dive in. All right. I'd like to say that I have Jim Carrey with me, but his name's actually Justin. But when he hopped on, I said, you know what? You bear quite a striking resemblance to a younger Jim Carrey. So I think you can take that as a compliment.
Absolutely do. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, John. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet. So where are you calling in from, Justin?
Despite all of this winter wardrobe, I'm calling in from sunny Florida. But for me right now, it is freezing cold outside. It's like in the 60s. I don't know what that is in Celsius, but it's really not that cold.
Yeah, the 60s, I don't know. If I'm trying to convert in my head, I'm like, I don't know, maybe the high teens or the early 20s or something like that.
That sounds about right. Probably what it is for you guys in like the summer or spring. Well, but it's cold for me.
Gets a little warmer. Are you a Florida native?
I am. I grew up in Central Florida. I grew up in Orlando. So even Orlando has two seasons, hot or not. Where I am now in Jacksonville, we get a little bit more of the seasonal change. We get some fall and some spring, and we get a little bit chilly in the winter, which I like.
Okay. Yeah. So you now are the a co-founder, I'd say now, like you've been doing this for a few years now, the co-founder of a nutrition and supplement company called Nutritional Roots. And it's just a coincidence that your last name is Root. Is that right?
Kind of. A little bit more than a coincidence. It kind of actually was a joke. We were having a trouble. I started Nutritional Roots with Dr. Todd Pesek. He's a medical doctor that grew up an Appalachian root doctor. And when we started this 2013, 2014, we were having trouble pinpointing a name. We had a long list of names. And I was on the phone with my dad, and he suggested, kind of as a joke, naming it after me, Nutritional Roots. And I thought it was kind of funny. So I pitched it to the doctor, and the doctor didn't think it funny. He thought it was a great name. He thought it fit perfectly. So we ran with it. That's been the name ever since.
That's awesome. And you said a root doctor, like specifically, so like using medicinal roots to help people out. Is this like in the realm of naturopathic medicine, or is he also a medical doctor, or what's sort of that designation?
Yeah, he's both. So he grew up in rural Pennsylvania on a self-sustaining farm. Basically a hippie village is what he grew up in. So he was surrounded by root doctors. He was surrounded by herbalists. He learned to live off the land growing up. But he was also inspired by the healers in his community. And he wanted to learn more about how to heal with plants. And he went to Northeastern in Boston and studied biochemistry. And from there, he went to the Ohio State University and got his medical doctorate. So he's a medical doctor licensed like any other doctor. He just has a very specific plant paradigm that he grew up with and he continues to use in his practice to this day.
That's fantastic. So that means should he choose, he would have the option of prescribing medications as well, but he would much rather not do that.
And that's exactly correct. Yep.
Yeah, and treat the whole person rather than just sort of mitigating symptoms, which is what a lot of our medical model is kind of built on.
Exactly. He kind of rebels against that in a lot of ways. And a lot of his patient base are people that are tired of taking prescriptions and have been prescribed things for all sorts of issues. And they come to him to see if there's an alternative. And sure enough, vast majority of the time, if not every time, he finds a way to transition them away from the pharmaceuticals and towards a more integrative, holistic approach.
Well, this is cool. And I don't want to make it all about him because we want to talk about you, but this is really interesting because I think this is a key component of what it is that you do. Does he get pushback from the medical community for the approach that he takes?
So he's been doing this now for about 15 years. And in the beginning, he got a tremendous amount of pushback. When he was doing this, plant-based wasn't really a term. He was this vegan hippie doctor. And he'll tell you a lot of stories. We can get him on the show at some point. He'll tell you a lot of stories going back to med school and getting in trouble. I think at one point in his residency, he got thrown out of the cardiology wing because he challenged why they were serving McDonald's to people that were recovering from heart surgery. And they were told, they told him he was being disrespectful and threw him out. So he ran into a lot of things like that in early days. But he was just kind of a little bit ahead of his time. Nowadays, he's got all sorts of doctors from all sorts of backgrounds coming to him, asking him about his protocols and his philosophy and his approach. So he's seen the tables turn over the last 15 years, I would say.
Which is absolutely brilliant. And I think whenever someone comes up with something that's even somewhat revolutionary, what does it say? First they ridicule you, then they try to tear you down, and then they start to follow you or something. I don't have that exact
something word, like that. But they mock you and then they steal your idea.
So how did you meet this gentleman here? Because we're gonna get a little bit into your backstory now.
Sure. Yeah. So our stories would intersect 10 years ago, like 2011. It was actually sometime in January in 2011. So almost exactly 10 years ago or 11 years ago now. I was living in San Diego, California, and I was working for a nutrition bar company. It was started by three surfers. It was called Banana Bars, was the name of the product. Clandestino was the name of the brand. And what they were doing, they were three surfers that had discovered this snack in Central and South America that was just a dehydrated banana. And they thought this would be a perfect candy alternative for kids in the United States. So they wanted to bring to the United States as a surfing candy. And it was just three SKUs, just a dehydrated banana. One was wrapped in dark chocolate and one was wrapped in milk chocolate. Eventually, we evolved to become more of a nutrition bar when we had some issues marketing it as candy. But one of our big accounts was a grocery chain called Heinen's in Cleveland, Ohio. And Todd Pesek, the doctor behind Nutritional Roots, had come on board to oversee their wellness sections at this grocery chain. They have over 25 stores, and they brought in a medical doctor to advise on all the health food products that are going in the store because they wanted to make sure that products were exactly as healthy as they claimed to be, and they wanted the doctor to validate that.
Okay.
Our product had a few little ingredient changes that he wanted to see. So I flew out to Cleveland to meet him and learn more about what they were doing in these wellness sections. And I had a half hour of his time, and I must have walked in there not looking pretty healthy, because instead of talking about the products, he wanted to explain to me how plant-based eating works. And he gave me his book, Eat Yourself Super. At the time, I was 260 pounds, hypertension. The doctor was warning me about prediabetes, the whole nine yards. So he spent more of the conversation talking about how I could change my life by eating plants, less time talking about the products. Okay. At the time, plant-based was not an option. I grew up playing football. I grew up meat center of the plate, vegetables on the side. Like, I just didn't even entertain, of all the ways to lose weight, I knew I wanted to lose weight. Of all the ways to do it, that was not going to be one of them. Read his book on the flight back and really didn't think much of it. Yeah. Until after trying pretty much everything else, I kind of decided to kind of give it a little bit of a go.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's shift back a little bit. So this, you'd been in about your mid to late 20s or at the time you met him, or?
Yeah. So I've been, mid 20s, early 20s, 24, 23.
Okay. Yeah. So how did you get to be 260 pounds?
That was the fun part. So I went to the University of Florida, graduated from the journalism college there. My first job out of college was working in New Orleans for a PR agency that specialized in hospitality PR, which meant a big part of my job was taking journalists to all the best bars and restaurants in New Orleans and all over Louisiana. So
it was terrible. I mean,
it was hard work. And I did it as much as I possibly could. And so, I love New Orleans. It's one of my favorite cities to this day in the entire world. It's just not a place that's a good atmosphere for a guy like me who loves to eat and work and have a good time. So, it really was, in college, I had some semblance of a structure too. I had some routine, and when I got my first job, this was in during the recession, right? So I really wanted to prove myself, and a lot of people didn't have jobs coming out of college. I threw myself into it and really gave up any notion of exercise routine or really paying attention to what I was eating or drinking or anything. I just wanted to consume it all the time. And I did. Right. And next thing I know, I could feel my temple beating in my heart when I'd walk up a flight of stairs.
That's quite something. So, I mean, was there a point in time where you looked in the mirror and you go like were you overweight as a kid, or is this something that just started like in your 20s here when you started eating kind of excessively?
Yeah. So I was a pretty, I was just a huge kid. Like I look back at pictures now and I laugh, like it's ridiculous. And by eighth grade, I was pretty much, I was like 6'1", about 210 pounds in eighth grade. So I was just like a big dude, my whole life. And so I went through, like a lot of kids, a pretty chubby, bordering on a little fat stage, before kind of puberty hit. So I was familiar with being overweight. But by the time high school came around, I was playing football. I was doing all sorts of things. I was pretty active. And I'd gained weight to play football towards the end. But college, I kind of lost all of that weight because I didn't need any more. So, I mean, I had kind of gone back and forth a little bit, different sizes in my life, but I'd never been at a point where I felt unhealthy. Even when I was playing football, I was still running around lifting weights. Like I was in shape. I was just kind of a thick shape.
So you say you gained weight to play football, which is kind of interesting. Does that mean that you were on like either offensive line or defensive line?
Yeah. So I moved to offense and defensive line my senior year. And so to make that transition, I gained probably 40 pounds, 30 pounds between, you know, beginning of my junior year and my senior year. But again, I was, you know, running around playing sports. So that was pretty easy to lose when I stopped playing football. I just kept moving and slowed down a little bit on the eating.
Right, right. So when you're trying to like gain, but this is interesting because this is a point in time when your brain is still like developing. So when someone says you got to gain weight to play this position and you got to eat more food and you're a teenager, like that doesn't sound like a terrible proposition. But if I was to sort of guess how you went about gaining the weight, I'm guessing you probably didn't. Well, why don't I not guess and say, ask the question, how'd you go about gaining the weight to play football then?
So you're kind of surrounded by dudes who are told similar things and are all kind of on a mission to thicken up. One of my buddies on the team ended up playing in college football and then playing in the NFL. And so I was just, and he had a lot of outside help and coaches and stuff influencing his decision-making. And I just followed a lot of his cues. Plus I'd seen guys ahead of me do a similar thing. So it is a lot of eating. You know, my mom always really encouraged us to eat healthy. And so at home we were eating, you know, pretty lean meats and whole grain carbohydrates and everything that was considered a health food in the early 2000s. But outside the house we would, I mean, one of my favorite, most decadent things, we called them cake shakes, and it's kind of disgusting looking back, but we would just take an apple pie. I mean, there'd be like three of us. We would take an apple pie and a carton of ice cream and a gallon of milk, and you just blend it together, and it is super delicious. But man, is that, yeah, that wrecks you. It really wrecks you. So you're eating healthy, but you're also supplementing with some really juvenile, like, fun things.
Well, like if you're wanting to gain weight, like ice cream, milk, and apple pie in a blender, yeah, that's good for you, right? Because
it's a calorie bomb.
Yeah, you've got your industrial fats. You're loaded with like tons of sugar, and you got a little. You could sort of argue that the milk and the ice cream have a bit of protein in there, but I think it's coming in at a lower end of the spectrum.
yeah. So you're doing little weird things like that. But you're also, I mean, you can't do too many weird things like that because you still got to exercise. So you can't eat purely junk food because then you don't perform as well. So it is surprising a little bit of a balance when you're trying to do that. I mean, the classic thing is peanut butter and jelly, just like constantly in between every meal, kids were eating peanut butter and jelly just to kind of get as many calories in throughout the course of the day as possible.
Yeah.
Without going too crazy.
So then did you think, that might have laid a foundation for a little bit of disordered eating here down the road?
That's a fair question. I think it goes back further than that, if I'm really being super candid. So the pattern of behavior there, I'm trying to think about where it would really kind of start. So I'm the oldest of three boys.
Yep.
And the three of us and my dad, we just love to eat. That is one of our love languages, is food. Is food a love language? Because it is in our house. And so being three big dudes, plus my dad is a big guy, and my dad was really and is still into fitness, but he was extremely into fitness my entire life. So he would work out for an hour and a half every morning. So he had an appetite to eat, and he was burning the calories he was eating. But I think there's just this modeling of behavior that started at a very, very young age, where my mom would put the food down, and if we wanted seconds, then we had to eat our food as fast as possible so that we could get seconds. Now, why we needed seconds or why we wanted seconds, I'm not really sure, because the first helping was plenty, but there's like mentality of like, if this is good, I should eat two servings of it. Right. And so you kind of get conditioned to kind of race towards the food. I remember bringing friends over for the first time to dinner, and then just being like, this is like a bunch of hyenas like out on the prairie, like you guys are just crazy. It's like, well, it's good, it's like we want to eat it, we want to eat as fast as possible. So you just kind of, I think it started a long time ago, just eating around the table, just really, really, really loving food. And when a bunch of people are doing that, you just overeat it, and you lose touch with why you're eating and the way you're going about eating it. Those disciplines, and even really even the metacognition of paying attention to how and why I'm eating, didn't even occur to me until my adult life.
Yeah. Now, and that's really, really, I mean, I appreciate you sharing that. And that's, I think that's really important, because, and why I wanted to shine a light on that is because I don't think we realize enough how much like the patterns laid down in childhood can really affect our eating patterns in adulthood, you know? And, you know, sure. And it sounds like, you know, yours wasn't necessarily an extreme case, because you also had, you know, like your mom and dad were interested in healthy food, and they also did model some healthy behaviors in terms of being active, and you were active in sports. But still, I mean, I think the idea, because I mean, my wife used to have to like put her hand on my shoulder and be like, you can breathe.
Yeah. That's another thing, you forget to breathe. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of disgusting. I mean, we also, I mean, choking too can actually become an issue when you're eating too fast and not drinking and not paying attention. It just seems ridiculous. And it seems like a very American modern day problem, but it's things that we created for ourselves back then, that even like, you know, Thanksgiving here in America is coming up next week, and we've all matured, but we still just like, when we're around each other, for some reason, like just instincts kind of take over, and we always just end up eating more around each other for some reason. And then we sit around and complain about how we don't normally do this, but when we're together, we go too crazy.
And so there's another really interesting thing that you're highlighting here. And that is when we get back into a pattern that's sort of familiar to us and brings us back to a happy place that, you know, connected to family and loved ones, because there is value in recognizing that we do as human beings, not just use food for fuel. And I think that is a good thing. Like food is history, it's culture, it's social connection, family. Like there is real value in that. We don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. But when these unhealthy, like you're going right back to memories of childhood when you sit down at that table, even though all of you have gotten older, and you're like, oh my gosh, I remember how I felt at childhood. And so, of course, it triggers these patterns that were really deeply ingrained when your brain was developing, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's pretty fascinating. And so we move forward a little bit here. So you go to college, or we would call it university, but you come out of it and you got a journalism degree, you go to New Orleans, you got these kind of patterns of eating, you love food. Now you're in the place where you're getting tons of good food. But I say good food, I mean, good tasting food. If I have it right, like Cajun cuisine probably involves a lot of like cooking in oils or fats and I'm imagining sort of like blackening things and stuff like that. So actually creating like acrylamides, and we don't have to go down that rabbit hole, but yeah, you're getting some really, really tasty food, but it's not necessarily prepared in the most healthy way.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, New Orleans, one of the reasons I love it so much is it's got a really rich history, especially for an American city that goes back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. It was originally settled by the French, and, you know, Napoleon Bonaparte had a little house there. Like it was a French territory for a long time. So that classic French technique is a big influence. But then you also had the slave trade coming through there, and so they brought a lot of their spices and stuff from the Caribbean. So it can be like a spicy version of like typical French country food. And so there's a big use of butter and there's a big use of cream, and they're not afraid to fry anything. Right. So those are a lot of the classic dishes. And then on top of that, they pair everything with copious amounts of alcohol, which is also doing a lot of damage calorically and metabolically and in all sorts of ways. So it's a lot of rich food. Now, we go back as much as possible, and the city is changing, especially as a lot of younger people move there. And there are a lot more healthier options, a lot more plant-based plus stuff. A lot of people just doing more fresh food in general, which is encouraging to see. But when I was there, it was rich food. I mean, one of the first meals I had, I'll never forget, was an alligator sausage cheesecake, which sounds disgusting, but it's actually delicious. And then that
alligator
was just the
sausage cheesecake.
Yeah. And then that was the appetizer. The entree was a rabbit that had been marinated in buttermilk for 2 days over a bed of macaroni and cheese. So I don't know what nutritionally beneficial qualities you can find in that combination. But that was the first meal, and I felt sick for about 24 hours after that one. But I would go back. I would go back. The place is called Giacomo's. It's an amazing restaurant in New Orleans. It's just, you got to be a little bit of a glutton for punishment when you're eating in New Orleans. That's why I only go back for a couple of days at a time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I think I would definitely try that just out of pure curiosity. I'd be taking like bile salts and digestive enzymes to go with it, though. I can tell you that right now. I'm probably drinking some bitters before I get started because I don't handle dairy very well. But and I've had alligator before, but alligator sausage cheesecake. You know, we have some friends here in the city I live in Red Deer, and every year they host a cheesecake party, and they make like 50 different kinds of cheesecake. It's crazy. And they're not all dessert cheese. Oh yeah, they're gonna make like a mac and cheese, you know, or with bitters cheesecake. Like that was one that sort of sticks out to me. They make like a turkey and stuffing cheesecake. So the idea, you can make all kinds of different cheesecakes. They don't always have to be a dessert one in one sense. And so, yeah, I remember trying to go there and like eat that. And, oh man, I felt sick after that. But the desire for novelty, it's like so intense. You see all these things and you're like, man, I've never had that before. Like, you know, probably 48 out of the 50 cheesecakes I'd never tried before. And I was like, and these are all handmade. I'm like, man,
wow.
I really want to try these different flavors and experience novelty, you know? And so,
yeah, I don't think I've had a savory cheesecake since that one. That was the first one I'd ever seen. Like, cheesecake to start? Like, why not? When in New Orleans, let's do it. But it was savory and it was delicious.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, then we get to this point, you're 260 pounds. And now, did the weight just kind of like creep on? Because one of the things that I like to say is that fat cells are the gift that keeps on giving, right?
Yeah.
Once you've created them, they're kind of yours for life unless you have them physically removed from your body, like unless you have a liposuction or some kind of surgical process that removes them from your body, they'll shrink. But because our body wants to keep us alive, and we have this beautiful famine biology. Now, it's kind of annoying because it makes fat cells pretty easily and it stores fat pretty easily. And even if you empty the cell, it's waiting to be refilled the next time you eat a caloric excess. So once so this is my biological reality, right? I say, like, I've been obese before, and if I don't pay attention to what I'm eating, I would become obese again because my body has all these wonderful fat cells just waiting to be refilled. So I'm pretty famine resilient. But did you find like the weight gain happened gradually or it started to happen pretty quickly, or what was the case there?
Yeah. So it was a little bit more gradual. I mean, there's definitely, you know, you're getting out of the shower and like, oh, buddy, you're putting on a few LBs here. But it really was until I started to really physically feel the effects of carrying that much weight that really started to pay attention and be like, wow, this isn't just like an aesthetic thing where you're getting chubby. Like, I'm winded walking up and down stairs. Again, I could feel my heartbeat, my temple when I'd be doing certain things. I used to be able to run and do exercise, and I went to the gym for the first time in like 6 months, and things that used to be so easy all of a sudden were extremely taxing. It was really those things that made me notice that I have this weird thing, and if there's a term for it, I think it might be under body dysmorphia, where like no matter what weight I am or how heavy I am, I still see the chubby kid from fifth grade in the mirror. So like I don't pick up the visual cues as much as the people around me tend to do. I mean, like when I can see my abs, obviously I can see my abs and that's really fun and great. But a lot of times when I'm trying to show off my abs, I'm also like in a caloric deficit that's not comfortable to maintain a lot of times. So like once those kind of abs go away, like whether it's like a flat stomach or a big stomach, whether my face is huge or my face is, I don't really see those things in the mirror, which is weird to say. But that's just kind of the reality I live with. So it really wasn't a visual thing that I noticed. It was more of just like the tax it took on my energy too. Like I noticed I was requiring more and more caffeine to get through the day, which was something that I was never dependent on because I was getting so tired, especially early afternoon after lunch. It was getting harder and harder to get through the day. Yeah, absolutely.
That's crazy to think about because this is happening to people. Like you were in your mid 20s at this point in time, should be heading towards your physical peak, especially as a male, because we tend to reach our physical peak at about 28 years old, give or take.
Mm-hmm.
And here you are probably feeling like you're in your 40s. Well, you didn't mm-hmm. know what to be for, but you just felt old. You felt like an old 25 year old where everything hurt, everything ached. Your sleep quality was probably crap. Your energy was crap.
Yep.
And now you're basically using caffeine like a credit card on your nervous system being like, keep giving me energy because I don't have it. And yet your blood pressure is going up and up and up, you know. And at this point in time, you hadn't met Dr. Todd. Is that correct?
That's right. I had no idea who he was when I was living in New Orleans, but I did know I needed a change. And so that was what kind of brought me to San Diego. It was like, I need to get out of this city and I need to get in an environment where there's healthier people that are going to motivate me to stay healthy and get back on track. So we were looking at a bunch of different markets. We were looking at Denver. We were looking up in Seattle. We were looking all sorts of, mostly around the West Coast, West side of the United States. Yeah. And the job opportunity came up in San Diego and I was like, that'll fit the bill. Let's give that a go. But I moved out there and, you know, I was just kind of hoping being around healthy people, I guess, would just like rub off on me. And it wasn't that easy. Like the weight, the weight kind of basically just stayed the same.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, cause, and the thing is the way that our brains are wired, you know, you'd laid down some pretty strong patterns there that weren't necessarily going to be so easy to unwire in a sense. And so you go to a doctor at some point and he goes, hey, like we need to put you on like a blood pressure medication in your 20s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And my first question was like, is this a temporary thing? Or like, am I supposed to take this the rest of my life? Like, what do you mean? Like I need to take a medicine here. And he said, well, technically, you don't need to take it the rest of your life. You just need to take it as long as, you know, your blood pressure is at this level. But every time I prescribe this, I don't see people coming off of it. I was like, so it's a life sentence. So I was like, well, what do I need to do to avoid taking this? And he was, well, you just got to lose weight. I was like, okay, I can lose weight. I lost weight in college after playing football. Like, I can lose weight. That doesn't seem that hard. And he goes, okay, but we're going to do 1 month follow-up here because 9 out of 10 times when people say they're going to lose the weight, they come back and just ask for the script. So that was kind of my experience there. Yeah. But I mean, I knew some quick little tricks to like move the needle like 3 pounds in that month, but I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I didn't know how to reverse my lifestyle. I didn't understand the importance of, you know, reverse engineering your lifestyle. Like you talk about a lot. That wasn't even a consideration. I was just like, what diet do I need? So I'm running through all the different diets. Keto, Whole30, South Beach, all the dumb named ones, and trying to force one into my life that fit, and none of them were working. So,
yeah, I was just thinking about that phrase that you put there. This doctor saying, every time I prescribe this, I don't see people coming off this medication.
Yeah,
like just hearing that makes me like cringe a little bit, or like clench up a little bit inside because I go, this is wrong.
Yeah.
This is not how this is supposed to be. Like, you know, you want to see me get feisty. It's when I hear stuff like that I go, you know, because, you know, I was in that situation or a similar situation, but I was in my 30s and I had to get checked out for additional life insurance and my blood pressure wouldn't come down. My waist circumference was huge. And my weight, I was obese still. I was still battling with this. And yeah, it was like, you have to get an extra rider on your life insurance because you're higher risk of dying, like dying sooner. Yeah.
I
mean, obviously we're all going to die at some point, but it was like you have to pay extra for your life insurance because you are statistically likely to die a lot sooner given your present condition.
Wow.
And I was like, oh my gosh, that was like, I gotta change something. Yeah, you hear that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Just the idea of being dependent on, like, I'm an independent dude. Like the idea of being dependent pill for the rest of my life, especially at that point, I was like, this is not the future. Like, how did I get myself here? Like, this is other people find themselves in this situation. What the hell am I doing here?
Yeah. And so, and it was by chance you end up meeting with Dr. Todd. Is it Pesek? Is that how you say it?
Pesek. Yeah.
Pesek.
P-E-S-E-K. Pesek. Yeah.
You meet Dr. Todd Pesek and he gives you a book and you're initially resistant, but eventually you move into plant-based eating. And does that mean presently that you are practicing like because I had a plant-based person on my podcast before, and she mentioned that like she's not a vegan, but she's plant-based, meaning that like if she, because vegan is more of like a lifestyle, you know, not wearing a leather belt or things like that, versus plant-based, meaning you're eating predominantly plant-based foods. And, you know, if she occasionally eats something like, you know, something that contains butter, she's not going to flip out over that. So would you put yourself into the vegan category or plant predominant, or
where do you fall in that? So I've never been vegan. That was never, but plant-based, whole food plant-based is always the goal. And where I land now is plant first. So it's just a big predominant bias for whole food plants. That's what I emphasize in what I'm eating. And I do that kind of just recognizing my lifestyle, my patterns, my behaviors. I'm an overeater. So if I'm going to overeat, it's better for me to overeat plants, which tend to be nutrient dense and calorie sparse, than it is something that's non-plant-based, which can be the other way around, like a little bit of butter or a little bit of cheese. You know, there's nutrients in there, but there's also a lot of calories packed per square inch into those foods.
Sure. Yeah.
So I try and limit those and try and reach more for the plants, which tend to fill me up, even if I am eating more than I probably should be.
And by plant, in this case, you're probably referring to like the non-starchy plant foods versus, say, potatoes, yams.
Rice, yeah, I mean, I definitely have a bias. If anything, it's visual, it's aesthetic. Greens, I love greens. So I just always try and have something green on my plate when I'm making something. And then as long as it's just a whole food, plant based, like even whole grain rices and stuff like that. Like I don't hold myself back from those things necessarily. I just avoid the white rices and the ones that have been bleached and separated. I try and keep it as whole food as possible when I'm doing the plant based stuff.
Yeah. And so by adopting this way of living, I kind of like the idea of plant first, because I say, it's really simple in one sense. My formula is basically a quarter protein, a quarter, you know, starchy carb, and half veg. Nice. That's the basic formula for my plate, you know?
Yep.
If someone makes a stew, it's not going to look exactly like that because it's all mashed together. But,
you
know, you do that most of the time, you're going to do pretty good. Like it's you're not going to get too wildly unhealthy. And I mean, I find myself moving into what I call the ethical omnivore movement as well. So eating more complete parts of the animal, which is really interesting, but we won't dive into regenerative and permaculture and things like that. Just, you know, so now your life, you adopt this plant first, you know, plant-based lifestyle, you lose 50 pounds. Kind of how long did that take you?
That's a good question. It was probably like, it wasn't one of those things where I was diligently on the scale.
Fair enough.
Towards the end, once I started seeing the weight came off. So probably after the first 25, 30 pounds, I started seeing a difference. Then I did start getting a little obsessive about the scale, and that developed a lot of unhealthy patterns too, especially towards the end, where I was just making all my decisions based on a half a pound or a pound, or way the scale moves one way or the other, and not taking into the entirety. I was taking my, first of all, overemphasizing what I weighed versus of all the variables to measure your health. I was overemphasizing that one, even though it is an important one. And then I was losing the context of what the weight was from day to day to day. Like your weight can't, I mean, I knew it was getting bad when I was limiting my water intake because I wanted to make sure tomorrow I was, you know, a half pound less. It was like, well, water's way more healthy than adding a half pound of water bait in 24 hours type thing. So I had to move away from getting off the scale. See, there you go. So it's
this water bottle here. Those who are listening, you can't see it, but it's a 750 mil. I don't know what it'd be, 24 ounce water bottle for American listeners. Pardon me. So by the time I'm done drinking this, I will have gained a pound and a half.
Yep. See, those things used to like, that used to change my priorities, were all messed up. And so if I'm doing this to generally be healthy and to take good care of myself and improve my longevity, improve my energy, get all those benefits, I can't be sacrificing water just for a silly number on the scale the next day. So I think, I would guess it took the first 50 pounds, maybe it took like 6 months. But then again, like towards the end, I was freaking out about the scale stuff. And then that became a whole thing where I had to kind of reevaluate, how do I measure my health and what do I care about?
Yeah. So what does that look like now? Because that's very interesting, because many people, like, because I think you and I would agree that the scale is a useful metric. It shouldn't be thrown out altogether.
100%.
But if you make it the solo or the primary metric, you're going to see problems, because other, when we look at health as a whole, like your weight, if you're 260 pounds, you're probably, unless you are like a bodybuilder, which you might actually be carrying unhealthy amounts of muscle, putting strain in your heart at that point. Either way, 260 pounds for most people, generally speaking, is not going to be healthy. All of this to say, what metrics do you use to kind of monitor your health now?
Yeah, so it's a lot more qualitative than quantitative. So I go annually and I get a physical, I get my blood work, I get all those numbers on an annual basis just to kind of keep track. And I kind of modify some things based on those feedbacks, that feedback. But it's really, it's just measuring how I feel, how I look. Like I do kind of pay attention to, like, I want to be able to see my top four little abs in the shower every morning. When those start to fade away, then I reconsider and reprioritize some of the things I'm doing. But it's really more about, like, how am I sleeping? Am I falling asleep when my head hits that pillow at the end of the day? Am I waking up rejuvenated energy? Am I waking up without my alarm clock? Am I getting through my day feeling great? It's also mental and psychological health. You know, I've had issues with depression and anxiety, especially at that weight. Like, that takes a big bearing on you. And so if I feel myself going, like during the quarantine, for instance, like I was just, there was just so much negativity in the news, and there was so much more time to be consuming that news. And I was just kind of felt trapped, and I started getting in my head. And that, you know, those moments are moments that guide me and determine kind of what I'm doing in terms of inputs and food and outputs with activity.
And again, you said something really kind of profound there, and I appreciate you being willing to share and being vulnerable, because, you know, when we talk about, like, between the before and after, like, if people hop over to, you know, say nutritionalroots.com, or, you know, and they look at you, they're going to see, like, this handsome guy who's in great shape, who's, you know, lost weight and is now living a very healthy lifestyle. It might lead people to think, like, everything must be, you know, ideal here. And in fact, you know, and I try to be open about my struggles as well for that very reason, so that we understand that really the journey isn't complete when we reach some arbitrary endpoint. It's, you know, maintaining our health is an ongoing thing. And I believe you talk about this in your podcast, Wealth Management, but you spell it W-E-L-L-T-H, which I absolutely love, because I love a play on words, Wealth Management.
Thank you.
And so you have kind of these other metrics for taking care of your health. And, you know, I think when I think about, like, carrying around extra weight, I imagine, like, extra inflammation, which is then going to exacerbate things like depression and anxiety as well. And so you have many, many good reasons why you want to monitor this. Thinking about consumption and overconsumption, we might also mention overconsumption of media and social media and its negative ramifications as well. Social media can be really powerful. Here we are sharing, you know, a very interesting story. We're sharing some powerful insights into health. That can be a positive thing. The flip side of that is when we start getting sucked into sort of the negativity trap as well. And so we're running a little bit short on time here. There's more I want to dive into your story, because I absolutely love it. So you get connected with Dr. Todd Pesek, and at some point in time he comes to you and he says, like, I want to start the supplement company, or how did that go?
So he had a small supplement line that he was calling Dr. Todd Superfoods, and it was mostly the herbs that he had kind of fell in love with from his travels, and then he had started using very successfully in his practice. So it was maca, matcha, and cat's claw were basically the three SKUs. And he'd always had this vision for a full line of supplements that was filling all the gaps that he was seeing in the blood panels of all of his patients. He went beyond just the herbalism into the micronutrients and kind of filling out that profile. So he had talked about that, and the startup I was at in San Diego ended up going under. I ended up moving to Jacksonville to be closer to my family, and my wife's family's in South Carolina. So we want to be on the set back in the Southeast. And I've always wanted to be kind of entrepreneurial and do something entrepreneurial. So we decided maybe this was an opportunity, and I was dabbling in a few other things at the time, just trying to keep my head above water. But then Nutritional Roots has started doing well. So then I was able to focus on that full time, which has been a fun ride.
Yeah, that's epic. And so, because starting a supplement company is no small thing either. I have a chemistry background, and I've spent some time in the supplement industry, and it's not just quite so, you know, cut and dry. Like, there's a lot of factors that have to come into play. And I think What we might have to do is, you know, I have another show called Wellness Unfiltered that I run Friday afternoons at 4:30 Eastern. And if we can swing that, I think we might want to bring on to, it's a panel discussion. And if you get Dr. Todd on there, that'd be super cool as well.
Yeah.
With my co-host. We call this Wellness Unfiltered, and we're trying to tackle everything that we see that's wrong with health and wellness and the medical industry as a whole, and try to be a voice for change, which I think you guys are doing as well. So,
yeah, no, I'd love to participate in that and share more of that story, because the first 5 years were one nightmare after the next trying to figure out how to make supplements, especially the way Todd wants to make them, because he needed them first and foremost for his patients. So he had the most ridiculously high level of quality that he was trying to strive for, and It was a nightmare trying to reach that bar, but we figured it out. But about 2018, 2019, we got it all dialed in. So it's been a fun ride.
That's amazing. Well, man, it's been such a pleasure chatting with you. I have so many more questions. Absolutely. So we definitely need to converse again. If you were to leave people with kind of one piece of wisdom from your experience, or one piece of advice you'd like to share with people who are wanting to get healthier, what would that be?
I would focus on the habits. And think about your life as a series of rituals, and stop paying attention to all the trends and what you can do for your next meal and you know, the next day, and start thinking about how can I slowly build little habits and little rituals that over time will compound. I'm certified in permaculture design, form of agriculture. And what I love about gardening is it's an amazing metaphor for your life. You got to take that little seed and you got to nurture it and nurture it and nurture it. And it just grows a tiny little bit every single day. But over time, it'll grow into something beautiful and bountiful and delicious. You got to treat yourself the same way and just water your seed every day, a little bit more at a time. And over time, something great will happen. So don't be discouraged when you don't get immediate results. Even though everyone's selling you those, it's really about playing the long game.
I love that, man. Plant the seed and then nurture it. That's great words to finish on. So thank you again so much for joining us. Thank you, everybody, for
tuning in. Thank you, John. Thanks, guys. Take care. This was a blast.
Thank you so much for tuning in to Between the Before and After. If you've enjoyed this episode, please like, share, subscribe, or leave a review, because that helps this podcast to reach and inspire more people. I love exploring the stories that take place between the before and after, the powerful experiences that shape who we become, and I love human potential. I love the possibilities that lie within us. So whatever you may be up against, I hope these stories inspire you. Because if you're still here, your story's not done yet, so keep moving forward.
Anyone can come from any place of brokenness and destitution and build an amazing life.